And there are dead bodies that would like to hide underground instead of under wreckage. The rescue teams, civil defense, and ambulance crews are not able to bear this tragedy alone in a country that endured grief and aggression in the aftermath of the war that weighed her down and exhausted her for years, as well as the unjust siege imposed on her. In the current talk about the responsibility of Western sanctions for exacerbating the suffering of the Syrians as a result of the recent earthquake, it is not only a matter of sanctions obstructing the arrival of urgent international humanitarian aid to the stricken areas. The most important thing is the cumulative impact of the losses caused by Western sanctions on the reality of Syrian capabilities, the conditions of the infrastructure, and the ability of service facilities to respond in cases of disasters and emergencies. Unfortunately, the world needed a catastrophic event such as the recent earthquake to finally see that Western sanctions do increase the suffering and the pain of Syrian civilians. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Today, the United States of America is the hub of global savagery, the source of absolute evil, and the real repository of terrorism that usurps peoples. After years of directing armed terrorist groups and seeking funding from Persian Gulf oil farms to destroy Syria, its infrastructure and foundations of the state's entity, strike its service institutions and logistical equipment, provide a complete cover for Daesh, and support it to tear the nation's map through religious fascism, the American occupation sits on the Syrian oil wells, relying on its cheap tools to steal it. It is truly a continuation of organized terrorism, especially today, as the U.S. illegal sanctions and blockade on relief operations in Syria killed Syrians under the rubble in the aftermath of one of the most devastating earthquakes the Levant has seen in more than 100 years. To discuss this issue with us from inside Aleppo, the city that has been officially dubbed a devastated city, is Antoine George Maqdis, a political commentator, founder and general director of Warsha, owner and founder at Samawar, and co-founder at SavePigs.Syria. You can find his work on Instagram and Facebook. I want to thank you immensely for being with us, Antoine, firstly, from inside Aleppo at these very difficult times. But the natural catastrophe that Syria was exposed to revealed the depth of the humanitarian catastrophe and the social factors such as food security and medical care and other human rights that are being denied by the West to the Syrian people for very false reasons. How did the situation look during this first week of devastation, and what would have made the relief better?
The situation is a catastrophe now, literally a catastrophe on the ground. You can't imagine the number of people that they lost their life. I can tell you stories and stories about what's happening on the ground now in Aleppo. You can't imagine. I've lived in Syria and in Aleppo in the last 11 years. I witnessed everything that happened during the war. But what happened the previous week, it was more than I could handle. My friend, the number of people who died till now, we don't know. There is more than 150 buildings that it fall down in Aleppo. Till now, there is no real numbers that we can depend on. The people till now, you can find dead people under their buildings. Today, I was in Latake, in the rural side of Latake, in Hama, in Jable. This is a Syrian catastrophe. This is a national catastrophe, what's happening now here. Till now, no one came to rescue or to pick up the people under the rubble.
It is devastating to hear it, as well as once we watch it as well, Antoine. I cannot imagine what you guys are going through, and I cannot thank you enough for taking the time and finding the place to actually be with us and tell the people of the world what is really going on and how the people of Syria are suffering. But the American occupation took advantage of the humanitarian submission of some Arab and some regional countries and governments, in addition to the European consent, obviously, and the ugliness of Western hypocrisy, which is based on lies and media misinformation in the name of what they call human rights and freedoms. Yet we saw a handful of nations from day zero, from hours after the earthquake, we saw states and people and nations breaking those Western-based rules and landing in Damascus and Aleppo to provide whatever is needed for the people. How can you describe the scene inside Aleppo, Hama, Latakia, and Tartus? And I know that today you were also in Jable as aid first started arriving on the day of the catastrophe.
This world now, it's not for human anymore. When there is a bully like the US controlling all nations, you are talking about humanity, humans without humanity. Look, during the war, what happened, everyone that lost his life, it was because of the war. But for me, as a Syrian civilian, as a Syrian citizen, each person who died during this crisis, his blood is on humanity. Now, thanks to a number of countries that they are like us, they are third world countries, there are people, there are countries who are under the American bullying, like Iran, Algeria, Egypt, UAE. Those people who are like us, they came to help us because they can feel our pain. But everything that happened till now, it's not enough. We are talking about one of the biggest waves of internal displacement in the history of Syria.
Can you tell us more about the relief? How is the relief and aid being distributed to the people affected?
There is a number of NGOs that they are doing their job on the ground. You can find now a number of Iraqi NGOs, like the Iraqi Red Crescent, the Iraqi civil defense. They are giving food packages, blankets, and most of the rescue teams who are like the professional ones, they came from Iran, Armenia, and China. Now, one of the beautiful things that I saw in the previous days, that you can see multicultural people who are coming in a human, in a humanitarian way to help their brothers in humanity. Most of the IDP centers now, they have been, there is countries who are sending food. They are making like Iranian, they are doing cuisines for the people so they can eat hot plates. Because as you know that Syria now, it's in winter and this is one of the coldest days in our year. So I saw many times a number of Iranian giving rice, soups to the people who had to flee their house.
Antoine, you are there, and we also have a lot of good friends in the West and in the Arab and Islamic world as well who are watching us right here on Press TV. They all want to pitch in, and they all want to help out during these very tough times. How can they do that? What is the best way to do that while maneuvering around the sanctions? What do you suggest?
Actually, there is three main things. The one who can come to Syria, we need him to come to Syria. Okay? We need people here. We need experts on the ground. Because the size of the catastrophe, we can't handle it alone. We need now people from all kinds of professionality. Like we need civil engineers, we need architects, we need doctors. We need a lot of people to help us. Second of all, we need an international advocacy campaign just to lift the sanctions on Syria, because everyone thinks that what we are living now in Syria is just because of the catastrophe that we had, the earthquake. But actually, we have been living under an American sanction for more than 14 years. Our infrastructure is destroyed. We don't have ambulance. We don't have a civil defense. Third of all, we need all kind of support.
Antoine Maqdis, it just breaks my heart to see you to see you in Aleppo, to see you how tough it is right now. I want to thank you very much for all the time that you have given us. I want to thank you for being there when we need to hear the truth. And we want to tell you that we are with you. We are with the Syrians. Antoine George Maqdis, a political commentator and founder of Samawer Warsha, and also co-founder of SafePix Syria. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, ladies and gents, I want you to stay with us because after the break, we are going to talk about how illegal those so-called sanctions are and how the U.S. actually did not break any of those sanctions. They did not lift any of them. It was just all in media hawks just after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The accumulated effects resulting from the Western sanctions imposed on Syria since 2011 constituted a major obstacle to the rapid response of civil defense teams and medical teams to rescue those trapped under the rubble of hundreds of housing units that collapsed on top of their residents in each of Aleppo, Latakia, Tartus, and Hama. In the current talk about the responsibility of Western sanctions for exacerbating the suffering of the Syrians as a result of the recent earthquake, unfortunately, the world needed a catastrophic event such as the recent earthquake to fathom that Western sanctions do actually increase the suffering and the pain of Syrians. More details about those sanctions in the following report.
While the final death toll until the writing of this report reached more than 4,800 people and at least 7,300 others were injured in Syria as a result of the 7.8 magnitude earthquake, a large number of international air cargo and shipping companies refrained from landing at Syrian airports and docking at Syrian ports for fear of U.S. and European sanctions. To clarify the impact of U.S. and Western sanctions in obstructing the rapid response to the repercussions of the recent earthquake, two reasons can be identified. First, the cumulative effect of the ongoing sanctions since 2011, which hindered the efforts of government institutions in their efforts to rehabilitate and repair infrastructure and service facilities and provide them with their work requirements and necessary needs. This cumulative effect is evident in the following results. Direct sanctions on the energy, construction, and reconstruction sectors, banks, and others, which prevented the country from securing its needs for modern machinery, equipment, spare parts, and technical support. Accordingly, these sectors were not in a position to deal with the repercussions of the earthquake without international support. The exchange rate of the Syrian lira decreased significantly during the years that followed the tightening of the U.S. blockade on the country at the beginning of the year 2019, as the exchange rate decreased from about 447 pounds in 2018 to about 6,800 pounds now. This decline left its direct and indirect effects on the country's ability to secure its needs of food, medicine, oil derivatives, technical equipment, and others. The high cost of importing goods and materials due to the high risks of dealing with Syria, where official estimates in Syria indicate that sanctions have contributed to an increase in costs by about 50%. The food and drug sectors are the most present here, despite Western talk of excluding them from sanctions, but they were actually affected to a great extent. As for the second reason for the impact of U.S. sanctions in weakening the Syrian response to the repercussions of the earthquake, it lies in the network of fear of dealing with the Syrian government, which the U.S. administration has been keen to spread around the world over the past years, whether through public pressure or indirect threats. Otherwise, what can be explained as follows. The reluctance of most international companies in many disciplines and sectors to cooperate and deal with Syrian governmental and private institutions, and they often require dealing through a third party, like a company in another country or a non-Syrian port. And the justifications are always the fear of exposure to U.S. sanctions. Unfortunately, this network of fear has reached companies and institutions in countries that do support Syria politically. What does that mean? It means more costs, expenses, living and health crises that Syrians are forced to bear despite the already difficult economic conditions. Governments are afraid of economic cooperation and sending relief aid to Syria before and after the recent earthquake. The most important example of this is Washington's refusal to grant the Egyptian government a written permit to export gas to Lebanon through Syrian territory, and its continuous pressure on Jordan to prevent the border crossing with Syria from operating at its full capacity. Despite the seriousness of the long negative impact of Western sanctions on the Syrian economy, the lifting of these sanctions can contribute within a short period of time to achieving positive results that will have an impact on the lives and livelihood of the population, such as quickly and remotely restoring the country's need for commodities and essential needs, especially in the health and food sectors.
To discuss this matter with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst and loyal expert in human rights and in sanctions, international sanctions as well. I want to thank you, Dr. Omar Nashabi, for joining us to talk about this very important matter at these very tough times. Now, the U.S. issued new Syrian sanction regulations on Friday, stating that it is giving authorization for transactions related to earthquake relief effects inside Syria. Now, Syrian banks still cannot receive wire transactions. Western Union, PayPal, and Patreon are global financial institutions that do not work inside Syria, and some of them do not work inside Lebanon itself. If we want to receive funds and send it from here to Syria as well. So what is it? I mean, was it just all a show by the U.S., this new statement they released, this new regulation that they're easing the sanctions? Are they not?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. And I want to start by expressing my deep condolences for the family of the ones who lost their lives in this terrible earthquake. And prayers go to those who are still stuck in the rubble of their buildings, and the wounded, and the many who have been also displaced, and they are suffering, profound suffering. And how ironic that, for the humanitarian aid to be allowed into Syria, it requires a license by the Treasury Department in the United States. That license number 23 was issued on February 9. The license comes 3 days after the earthquake took place. What was barely needed in the first was the first hours when, and the first days when people were still, there was high hopes that people were alive under the rubble. We needed that equipment. We needed that aid. We needed these teams to be there and to be equipped. We needed the money to actually allow them to move around in a fast way and to actually get people out from under the rubble and provide them with the basic needs that they require in order to stay alive. This was not possible because the actual license came 3 days after, and it is only a license for NGOs and for people who are not related to the Syrian government, whereas the Syrian government has the actual capacity to move on the ground. And the Syrian
government, which means that even wiring money to Syrian banks is not allowed because it has to go through the Syrian Central Bank, which is exempted from this license, isn't it?
Exactly. It's exempted from the license because it's related to the Syrian government. So the license said explicitly that anything related to the Syrian government is not allowed to be, is not included in this kind of license. And that actually exacerbates the suffering because we cannot get the money in order to get the heavy equipment and the actual capacity of the rescue teams to help these people who are still stuck under the rubble. And, now we have a huge humanitarian crisis with the people who are displaced in the hundreds of thousands. Who's going to actually find a living space for them?
That we also are, as the Syrians are suffering from the cumulative effect of the ongoing sanctions that started in 2011. So, people were not able, the government was not able to help the people because they were hindered to begin with. The institutions were not rehabilitated. The infrastructure was not ready because of 11 years of war.
Yes.
Do that have no weight according to international law? Who bears the responsibility of this deliberate suffocation, especially after this catastrophe?
Well, the sanctions were created a phobia, an international phobia. So every nation, that some nations in the West wanted to help, but they can't because they are afraid that they will be hit by U.S. Sanctions and measures against them by the U.S. government. So this kind of terrorizing terrorizing regime in the United States, terrorizing authority, terrorizing anyone who wants to help people who are suffering from an international disaster. It's horrible, and you know this is creating more and more deaths in Syria, because and the responsibility goes to the United States government. Responsibility is the responsibility of the Security Council. I believe that the Security Council, according to the law, is in charge of peace and security around the world. So the members of the Security Council must take immediate action to allow all humanitarian aid to go into Syria.
Antonio Guterres is going to Syria next month, so I don't think he cares enough to try and solve this. But since you're saying that people must help in every way possible, what are ways, in your opinion, that that countries or states or entities outside Syria can bypass these sanctions? I mean, Lebanon is one of those, but what really can they do?
Let me first say that bypassing the sanctions in these circumstances is a humanitarian duty. Everybody around the world and all the NGOs and regimes and people and anyone around the world should actually bypass these sanctions and get the actual basic aid that is needed by the Syrian and Turkish people. I mean, the Syrian people especially, because they are under so many restrictions, and it's all, you know, based on an act, an American unilateral kind of blockade on Syria that is depriving it from rebuilding the very basic necessities for the Syrian people. In fact, I just want to also point out, before I continue answering your question, to a resolution that was passed by the Security Council of the United Nations itself in 2013, the resolution number 68/200, that considers that any unilateral sanctions such as these against a developing country is counter the actual principle of international law and the principles of the United Nations. These sanctions, who's suffering from these sanctions? The Syrian people, the regular people. They are saying that these sanctions target the government. Well, the people are the number one, they are suffering tremendously. And in situations like this, it is truly unacceptable. And really, after today, you know, talking about humanitarian work and humanitarian principles is really, I mean, nonsense if these sanctions are not lifted immediately. The Syrian people are in dire need for any kind of humanitarian assistance. A lot of the assistance came from Lebanon, some of the assistance. I mean, Lebanon has also limited capacities. Hezbollah sent yesterday a large convoy to Latakia. This is and there's another convoy moving today and tomorrow to support our brothers and sisters in Syria. It's very positive, and one must say and recognize that some Arab countries, Gulf countries like the Emirates, have provided help for the Syrian people. This is very much appreciated, and I think this is important. This goes back to the root of our humanitarian principles. It is. I take this advantage from being here with you to actually call upon anyone around the world to help the people of Syria. This earthquake could happen anywhere to anyone.
Definitely. Dr. Omar Nashevi, political analyst and lawyer expert in human rights and international sanctions, thank you for being with us. I want to advise every one of you, ladies and gents, to follow Al Qaws, which is the magazine that Dr. Nashevi publishes in. He wrote extensively about why the sanctions should be removed and how they can be removed. I want to thank you, ladies and gents, for following us, for being there, especially right now, especially for the Syrians, especially for those who have no voice. We are their voices. Look, our minister in Lebanon said that the airport in Lebanon and the ports of Lebanon are open to help the Syrian people. So please send the help that Syria needs. Lebanon is open for all countries, especially European countries, to help Syria. If you don't want to be sanctioned by the U.S., come along. Come to us in Lebanon. We are more than happy to take whatever you bring to Syria, because we don't care about the sanctions. We care about brothers and sisters who are under the rubble in Aleppo, Latakia, in Hama, and in Tartus, and also in the northern occupied territories as well. We need help for everyone. We will see you again, hopefully in better times, next week on the Middle East Stream.
congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 27th of Rajab, the Feast of Mab'ath, which marks the formal appointment of Prophet Muhammad by God for guidance of mankind. We at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims on this auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
Millions of Americans are about to be forced to cut up to $258 a month out of their grocery budgets as emergency food stamps suddenly end in March. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Business Insider noted millions of Americans are staring down a potential hunger cliff come March, and many may not be aware that they are about to lose hundreds from their grocery budget. That's because yet another pandemic-era benefit is winding down and is likely to leave older adults with fixed incomes scrambling amidst high food prices. As HuffPost first reported, 16 million households will see their benefits drop by $82 a person, what the Food Research and Action Center, FRAC, estimates is the average amount that every SNAP participant will lose a month. Beginning in March 2020, SNAP was expanded to allow households to receive the maximum benefit instead of income testing and allocating aid based on how much they earned. That meant that a household of one, generally an older adult, went from getting $23 a month to $281, according to Gina Plata, Deputy Director for SNAP at FRAC. At the same time, the lowest earners who are normally eligible for the most assistance received an additional $95 on top of the benefit. But the omnibus passed in December stipulated that those emergency allotments will come to an end in March, marking yet another example of federal social policy abruptly winding down. That means the recipients getting $281 will fall back to $23, a $258 decrease. Instead, the enhanced SNAP benefits will go the way of enhanced unemployment benefits, free school lunches, and the child tax credit. All provided a safety net and helped keep hunger at bay for many Americans. But there is little legislative appetite to renew them. The following map shows not only which states are facing an abrupt cutoff of SNAP benefits soon, but just how many households will be affected. The states in gray in the map already have had the emergency allotment expire. As seen in a map, around 30 states and Washington, D.C. would be affected by the abrupt cutoff of SNAP benefits. Based on figures from FRAC, 393,341 households in Alabama, for instance, would receive emergency allotments of SNAP in February 2023. That's about 200 households per 1,000 American households in the state. D.C. and New Mexico may feel the largest impact from this cutoff based on estimates per 1,000 American households. Now, Plata said states are scrambling to get the word out to residents that their benefits are being dramatically reduced. Plata said the last thing you want is Grandma Sue showing up to the grocery store all of a sudden like, where is my money? This is what I had budgeted. That's the hunger cliff that we're facing in the U.S. That people had this budget, things haven't gotten better. And now you're going to a grocery store where things are more expensive. And those grocery shoppers are also coming up against higher prices, especially on essentials like milk, eggs, and orange juice. According to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the price of a gallon of whole milk has increased from $3.74 in December 2021 to $4.21 in December 2022. Prices for a dozen large grade A eggs saw a massive uptick from November to December, $3.59 to $4.25, and hugely up from the year before, when they were $1.79. Some states in the U.S. are stepping in to try and fill the gap left by the end of beefed up SNAP benefits. New Jersey increased the minimum benefit that residents can receive, and Massachusetts is moving to try and keep payments higher for 3 months, albeit at 40% of what recipients get now. But the loss of benefits wholesale will have a real human toll and a ripple effect on local economies. Plata added in this regard, one of the things that we forget is that for every dollar that American people spend on a SNAP, it stays in the local economy and it translates to about $1.70 to $1.80 in increased economic activity. Those losing emergency allotments will still see the same high prices and rents, but they will have less money. You will going to see, as the months go along, more American families being hungry, more people visiting food banks, and just seeing the terrible effects that this had on all of these people.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
In this modern day and age, we've seen capitalism, materialism, liberalism, and globalization spread across the world and impose itself on other cultures, led by Western political and economic powers, specifically post-Cold War American capital. As such, modernity, with its goal of institutionalizing a number of evolving principles such as moral autonomy, human rights, civil equality, consumerism, freedom of the market, and secularism, have proven to be a great challenge to various religious traditions and communities, particularly Islam. In the modern secular world, religion should have no influence in the public sphere. As a result of the secularization of society within the Muslim community, we are witnessing a number of shifts in the way people view certain ideas, concepts, values, morals, ethics, and accepted religious tenets and practices. One of those shifts was how the concept of gender found a new meaning in post-revolutionary Iran. After the 1979 victory of the Islamic Revolution, one of the issues that became a hot topic and was seriously paid attention to and discussed domestically and internationally was the issue of women. The Islamic Revolution achieved victory in an environment where various schools of thought, including modern secular ideologies, had promoted their ideas of gender issues and a specific view of women. But the Islamic Republic brought a new perspective to humanity in this matter. The new approach became the reality in the form of activism and day-to-day activity of Iranian Muslim women. Therefore, the third model for women was born, a new model that outlines a new life pattern for women and dismisses the previous models introduced by both Eastern and Western schools of thought. For a closer look at this movement, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. The concept of the third model for women was raised initially on March 6, 2012, by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader has said that the first model for women, which emerges from the Eastern school of thought, considers women as an element on the margins of society, playing no active role. The second model concentrates on women according to Western viewpoint, which considers women as a creature based on her gender, not humanity. Based on this ideology, women are treated as a commodity for the pleasure of men or a means at the service of capitalism. However, the third model considers women as the constituents of the revolution, who are neither inclined toward East nor West.
How do you describe the woman's role and their situation in society currently after the revolution?
One of the basic strategies of the Islamic Revolution and the discourse of the Islamic Revolution on the issue of women is the revival of identity and the recognition of women's female identity. What was going on before the revolution following the degenerate Western culture was that women had lost their identity even as a human being. The fact that the woman is a human being and has will, decision, and authority and freedom. That a woman has an identity along with the identity of being a mother, being a wife, and being a comforter for the family. But this view of women was changing according to the Western culture in the Pahlavi regime. History has it that the Pahlavi regime had suggested that if a woman wanted to be a human being, she had to be Western from head to toe.
Islam regards women as dignified human beings. Men and women share the same characteristics in that sense. A human is a human before being a man or a woman. People are equal as far as human nature is concerned. This is the Islamic view. God has bestowed certain physical traits on men and women. Both men and women play a role in creation, in the growth and transcendence of humanity, and in the course of history. But the role of women is more important than that of men, according to Islamic scholars.
For example, we have a female researcher who has been doing research for more than 40 years with her husband in a peaceful life with four children. She's a successful mother, a successful wife, and a successful researcher. Or we also have female athletes in different departments who hug and breastfeed their children on the side of the sports field. Anyway, my emphasis is on their identity. And that identity that has been lost in the West, and today the Muslim woman is giving it as a gift to the whole world. This sense of being a mother, a sense of being a wife, a sense of comfort to the family is a part of the Iranian woman's identity, and this is what she is giving to the world.
The most important duty of humanity is to help the reproduction cycle. In this regard, the role of woman is incomparable to the role of men. The West, which has strayed from the righteous path, calls these things limitations, while they treat women as a commodity and label it woman's freedom. These are among the plots that the West has carried out regarding human rights issues.
In the Western culture, woman actually stands in an inferior place and is looked upon as an object or a tool. During the Industrial Revolution, the domineering view towards woman was very unpleasant because the Western woman was devoid of her own identity. No property was registered in her name, and even after she got married, she still had no rights. her last name changed to his husband's last name. If you read Joan of France's famous letter under the name A Letter from a Christian to Muslim Women, in that letter she clearly says that we Western women no longer have an identity. The American woman is not the woman that Hollywood shows. That reality of an American woman is me, who always has to go to sleep by sleeping pills. And in fact, I have no support.
In relation to Western plots, some activists from the Iranian Muslim Woman Movement have made a noteworthy statement recently saying, those who are responsible for killing countless women and children in Yemen, Afghanistan, and Iraq cannot tell us about woman, life, and freedom, of course.
If women do not take part in a social movement of a nation, that movement will not gain any results and it will not succeed. If they do, however, decide to participate in a movement with awareness and insight, that movement will accelerate. In the great waves of Islamic awakening in history, women have played an unparalleled role, and it is necessary for them to continue playing this role.
In the past, we have clearly witnessed the significant role women played during the time Iranians were fighting the Pahlavi oppression in Iran and after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. If they had not fought in the battlefields during the 8-year Iraq War, which was imposed on us, the country would not have achieved victory during those difficult times.
In many of the issues raised by Imam Khomeini, the roles of women and men are seen side by side. He says that all these disturbances that exist, men and women should work together to solve them. And therefore, I want to tell you that the approach of the revolution to the women's issue was that women should come and take part and play a role in the destiny of the country. The record of the Islamic Republic itself is very clear in this matter. The achievements of the Islamic Revolution in the field of women's education, the role that women play in the international arena, such as sports and other arenas, such as politics and foreign affairs, show that the Islamic Republic, according to Imam's approach, was concerned about including women. The Islamic Republic does not consider only the role of family and housework for women. It considers women as a social element that, according to its social responsibility, should play a role.
Indeed, our women helped us achieve victory time and again. The mothers and wives of the martyrs and war veterans created a feeling with their patients in which our youth and men were encouraged to have a determined presence. And this positive feeling spread to every part of the country. As a result, the general atmosphere of the country was filled with selflessness and self-sacrifice, and we achieved victory.
You see, in the debates that the Imam had in the field of women at the beginning of the revolution, many clerics may have not agreed with him, but this approach was changed by Imam's view. In fact, he changed this paradigm that women are important. The role of women in the civil society is important, and that the presence of women in the community does not have the objectification effect, and she can play her role effectively.
After the Islamic Revolution, we have issued at least 200 laws to protect women, which is perhaps unique in the world. We have the Supreme Family Council, which is chaired by the president and has a legal basis, and in which the president has the duty to pay attention to the issues and problems of the family, including the mother or the wife of the family. Therefore, there are many protection laws for women. Recently, the law on protection of women and protection of women's safety is actually being reviewed in the parliament and is going through the final stages of approval. For example, if there is no light on a street and the darkness may endanger women's safety, the municipality is obliged to immediately install lights on that street to eliminate the possibility of danger for women.
Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Republic, understood the importance of the role that women could play. Otherwise, there were certain luminaries among our religious scholars who had to be convinced it was necessary to let women take part in the demonstrations. They used to say that women should not take part in the demonstrations. This is the case today in the world of Islam, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Bahrain, in Yemen, and in every other place. If women strengthen and continue their presence on the front lines, they achieve victories one after another. There is no doubt in this regard. In any case, the role of women is a unique role, and Muslim women must stay present on the national scene. This is necessary for the future of Ummah.
I believe that nowhere in the world girls and women are as much free as in Iran to participate in social activities. You see women in parliament, in managerial positions, and on the streets and parks. Even in order for women to be more free and comfortable, they have built women-only parks that are unique in the world.
We must make efforts regarding the issue of women and try to preserve the potential that exists within our societies in this regard. This is why we must actively discuss the issue of women and their significance in our present societies.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media.
Here's how it looks on the page. According to Tasnim News, Iran's women's ice hockey victorious over UAE at Kazan Cup. Iranian women's ice hockey team defeated the UAE 4-0 at the Russia the Islamic World Kazan Summit 2022 tournament on Sunday. The Iranian women's team had lost to Tatarstan 4-1 in its opening match. Team Melli Banuan will play Bahrain in its next match. The international event is being held in Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan, from January 13 to 18. The tournament has brought 12 men's and 5 women's teams together in two arenas, the Sports Palace and Tatnef Arena. The decision to hold the competition was made within the framework of the International Russia the Islamic World Kazan Summit 2022. More than 300 hockey players from 14 Islamic states are taking part in the tournament. IFP News reads, how two Iranian women reached the peak of Mount Everest. Over the past years, many Iranian mountain climbers have successfully reached the top of Mount Everest, which sits in the Himalayan heights. But prior to May 2022, no Iranian woman had managed to get to the peak of the world's highest mountain. Afsaneh Hesami Fard, originally from Iran's North Khorasan province, finished climbing to the top on Saturday, May 14th. She went to Damavand on April 6th and joined a week-long training camp there before setting out for Everest. Ilham Ramezani is a former member of Iran's national squash team. She is known as the second Iranian woman who has succeeded in reaching the peak of Mount Everest this year. She announced via social media that she had reached the finish spot at 9 a.m. on May 15th. Iran Press reads, Women of Influence exhibits Iranian achievements. The exhibition was held simultaneously with the first International Congress for Women of Influence, which kicked off on January 20, 2023. The first International Congress for Women of Influence was held in Tehran on Friday with female guests, including wives of heads of state, ministers, vice presidents, and parliamentarians from Burkina Faso, Kyrgyzstan, Serbia, Guinea, Niger, Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Syria, Turkmenistan, and Armenia. Iranian exhibitions showcase the latest achievements of successful Iranian women entrepreneurs and active in various fields like electricity, electronics, medical equipment, technology, innovation centers, and homemade products. Today, one of the greatest problems of the Western world is the breakup of the family environment and an increase in the number of orphan children. The West is suffering from the consequences of neglecting family values and will suffer more, according to sociopolitical analysts. These social developments have built up over time, and the West appears to be harmed greatly by this problem. This flashy, materialistic civilization will certainly collapse along these social fault lines if it continues to ignore the basic and fundamental values of humanity.
We believe that families are similar to a community, a small society that has rules, and these rules are necessary for it to survive. One of these rules is that the family members should care about each other. It's not like anyone can do whatever they want. Societies won't work like this. Can anyone do whatever they want in a society? No. The law imposes restrictions, and this is very natural. Therefore, the wife must ask permission from her husband to go out or go abroad. This is exactly the internal harmony within a small community, and this shows that family members care about each other.
Islamic scholars believe that Western countries have to be condemned when it comes to the status and situation of women. They describe Western women as being alienated in their societies, while pointing out that the Western capitalism is a patriarchal system, criticizing it for allegedly giving people's capital and financial assets more value than humanity. Also, criticizing it for letting men make more money than their women counterparts in the work environment. Meanwhile, the top Islamic leaders in Iran believe that the employment of efficient, experienced, knowledgeable, and wise women in the country's decision-making arenas is of high importance. They believe that the revolutionary process has made a significant effort to see a strong role played by Iranian women in various sectors of the society. In light of these efforts for women's active presence in the society, today the absolute and relative number of female researchers, professors, scientists, intellectuals who work in different areas as experts, poets and artists such as fiction writers and painters, etc., is far greater than the number of such women during the time of Pahlavi regime. In that regard, what is published against Iranian women in foreign media is not based on facts. In the recent hybrid warfare against the Islamic Republic, much effort was spent to portray the woman's status in Iran as inferior, completely ignoring the accomplishments of women in the past 44 years of the Islamic Republic.
I'm serving you as a representative of people. Expressing demands is a public right. Every Iranian citizen has the right to express his or her demands, and the Constitution provides this opportunity. The form of our parliament and our city councils is in such a way that, because they receive votes directly from the people, they have direct interaction and communication with the people, and that they actually listen to the demands of the people. This is the basic approach that I usually see my colleagues have. They are serious about this matter, and I know that this approach exists in city councils and similar institutions. I think that listening and talking and communicating and seeing women's demands definitely helps to improve the status of women's society.
Today in the Islamic Republic, there are many female figures in different areas such as science and academia, politics, culture, sports and arts who wear the hijab in the form of chador or headscarves. And their accomplishments and progress is an indication that observing the Islamic dress code is by no means an obstacle for them to reach their full potential. In the Islamic and divine view of a woman, she possesses so much beauty, tenderness, and loving warmth that she can push both herself and the people around her, whether in the household or any other environment, towards spirituality, progress, and highest levels of science and pragmatism. Today, our educated women are the most pious and revolutionary people in our country. Today, our educated young women are active in the most advanced laboratories and scientific and scholarly centers. Our pious and revolutionary youth are among the most active women in political, scientific, and managerial areas. They think critically and understand cultural resistance in the face of Westernization.
The families' trust in Islam or the Islamic Republic also made them send girls to schools. Literacy should be considered as an important issue for our women and girls. We had a high rate of literacy growth after the revolution. And alhamdulillah, now literacy and higher university and supplementary education for women are among the indicators brought by the Islamic Republic. The traditional community felt that the path that the revolution is following in the field of women issues are compatible with the values and norms of the Iranian society. And for this reason, the traditional society also supported all the concerns that the Imam had regarding the presence of women in the society.
Furthermore, when we take a look, we see that the name of our woman have been written on many books, including scientific, research-based, historical, literature, political, and artistic books. The writings of our woman, whether articles or books, are among the best writings in the Islamic Republic today. This is really a source of honor and pride, and it is unprecedented in our history.
You see, before the Islamic Revolution, we didn't have a handful of writers at that time, but today we have more than 14,000 writers at the national and international level. There are thousands and thousands of volumes of books written by women, books that have been republished for even 120 to 140 times. This actually tells about the manifestation of the spirit of freedom of Iranian women. Or let me say, in the academic field, before the Islamic Revolution, we didn't have even 1% of university faculty members. Today, more than 40% of our faculty members are women, and they are cultured, thoughtful, and educated. Before the revolution, our women's sports fields were very, very limited, and maybe only one or two fields were open for women, and they had to be trained by men coaches. Today, we have more than 48,000 female coaches for various sports fields. And anyway, the world is seeing Iran's dear girls and women shine on the championship and medal-winning platforms.
Iranian women have also proven they can contribute greatly to the advancement of sciences, as 345 female researchers are on the highly cited researchers list of the world. They have also played their role in the scientific authority of Iran, and in the list of 2,795 Iranian highly cited researchers, which includes researchers in the top 0.1%, top 1%, and top 2%, there are 345 Iranian women scientists. In addition, there are so many examples of successful Iranian female athletes who have stolen the international scene over the past years, including para-archer Zahra Nemati. She took up archery in 2006 and has since become one of the most decorated and most influential para-archers of all time. Nemati has won 3 Paralympic gold medals, 1 silver and 1 bronze. Parachuter Sare Javanmardi also is one of the most decorated Iranian athletes. Known as World Pistol Queen, Javanmardi has claimed 3 gold medals and 1 bronze in the Paralympics. In the 2018 Asian Games, the women's kabaddi team won the title for the first time ever, beating the Giants of Kabaddi India in the final match.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Do tune in same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. When the term de-dollarization was coined, there was a concrete idea behind it, that the U.S. currency would be uncrowned someday. And when we talk about the U.S. decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and the end of dollar hegemony in the world. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar, as world economies are exhausted by the U.S. military and financial bullying. So efforts are underway around the world to topple the dollar. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Global Times, Russia's finance ministry said will reset the share of euro in its National Wealth Fund, NWF, starting from this year, leaving only gold, Chinese yuan, and rubles, Russian media reported recently. It not only means the drastic change to Russia's sovereign reserve structure as a strategic power, but also directly promotes the internationalization of yuan to a higher level, analysts claimed, noting that such move will also